Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now it's time for our Friday gathering, and this week I'm joined by Fianna Fáil TD for Kildare North and member of the Oireachtas Foreign Affairs Committee, James Lawless, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and party spokesperson on housing, Eoin O'Brien, assistant news editor at the Business Post, Sarah McGuinness, and columnist with the Sunday Times and barrister, Brenda Power. And you're all welcome. Thank you for coming in today. We'll start with the report from the Housing Commission. We were discussing it earlier with Michael O'Flynn, who sat on the Housing Commission. The report says we have a strategic shortfall of 256,000 homes. The HAP system is inflationary. We're spending more. We're getting less, though, from all that spend than almost every country in Europe. And then we have Michael O'Flynn, who says he put a lot of work into it and he feels as though the report is being undermined by the Minister, James Lawless. Firstly, it's hardly a record of success. And then we have the response of the government, which is upsetting to at least some of the Commission members.
Yeah, so I listened to the interview on your programme the other day with the chair of the commission, and I noted carefully what he said. He said a number of, I thought, quite optimistic things. First of all, he was optimistic himself, which is good news. Some of the government measures he described as being very effective. I suppose he was looking to the long-term strategy, and that's what government asked him to do. And I suppose not forgetting the report was a government task force commissioned and funded by the government to go off and do this work. And the government has been in office since 2020, so we're in year four of what's probably a 24-year plan. I mean, this is a long-term, long haul, and what the commission was looking at.
You're being generous there now, because you were in confidence supply prior to that.
I don't remember any Fianna Fáil ministers sitting around the table from 2016 to 2020, and that's because there were none. So from a distance, and I gave numerous speeches in the House critiquing government housing policy in that period. So I suppose I can only speak as a Fianna Fáil TD to the last 4 years. But part of that is looking forward.
But did you hear Michael O'Flynn this morning?
I mean, I didn't hear his latest comments.
I'll tell you what he said. He's really upset about the minister's reaction to this. You know, the minister coming out and saying, sure, we're doing three quarters of what the Housing Commission report recommends anyway. And also shooting down, it would seem, the idea of this strategic executive, which the minister says at first glance he doesn't feel that they need. And that is a central recommendation of the Housing Commission report.
Yeah, well, look, I suppose it's the prerogative of government to accept or reject recommendations from any body or any agency. And of course, people, I didn't hear Michael Flynn, but of course, people in the sector, naturally, some will be glad, some will be disappointed by different responses. But I think the key thing for me is this is a long-term projection. And the government have always said that this is the Housing for All. It was a 5-year plan, but to grow to, you know, a 10, 15, 20-year plan, probably. And it's always been part of the plan to revise those targets. So we started off, I think, with 30,000 per year. That's not only been met, been exceeded. So I think we're on 31, 32,000. When we look forward to the year ahead, it's going to be beyond that again. Growing to 40,000 over this decade was always the plan. And so we're actually ahead of target on that. And we need to go higher. There's no doubt whatsoever. We need to be hitting 40,000, 50,000. And that's always been part of the plan here. So I think the report is confirming what a lot of us probably suspected anyway. Greater ambition, not greater spending, because one of the things he said was we're not getting value for money. And I think housing costs in Ireland, the other thing the report strongly majored on was the legacy issues, infrastructure, the lead time, getting water connections, getting roads connections. I know the LIHAF, Local Infrastructure Housing Assistance Fund, has been trying their best to do that. But this is a big, long supertanker trying to be turned around. And Darragh Ryan is at the bridge for the last couple of years trying to turn that tanker. He's done quite well. But this is a big, long-term play. Okay. This is not an overnight fix.
All right. Michael O'Flynn's criticisms today of the government response. He agreed when I said to him, do you feel undermined, or that the commission has been undermined by the ministerial response? But just on the issue of HAP specifically,
sure.
I mean, Eoin O'Brien, your government, you've criticised the government for handing over 10 billion over 13 years for HAP. But by the same token, you've called for increases in spending on HAP. So it's difficult to read your position on that particular one.
No, in fact, it's important to understand that the two things go hand in hand. Every housing system needs a housing benefit, a short-term support that allows people, while they're either waiting for social housing or they're in a temporary issue in terms of their employment, can afford their rent. And therefore, in the model that we've always argued for, which is a temporary housing support or housing benefit, the rates have to be equivalent to market rates and the processing times have to be timely. That's always been our position. We absolutely agree with the Commission. In fact, when the legislation for HAP was introduced, I think Janet Sullivan was the junior minister in housing at the time, We argued strongly against what that legislation did, which was for the first time turn what were previously temporary supports into long-term supports. Under law, HAP is seen as in exactly the same way as long-term social housing.
So you want HAP to be higher, to come faster, but to be shorter lived?
What we want is far, far less people in long-term rental subsidised tenancies. So if you were delivering large volumes of permanent social homes, and if you were treating a HAP and rent supplement as a short-term measure, the bill would be far, far smaller because less people would be on it and for shorter periods of time. Mm-hmm. And that's not just our view. It's the view, for example, of the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. They've done a detailed survey of this to say the use of current expenditure, exactly what John O'Connor was saying yesterday, the use of current expenditure to provide long-term public housing supports is the wrong way to do it. And Fine Gael in particular, but they've been supported by Fianna Fáil in this, have over-relied on the private rental sector to meet social housing need rather than building the volumes of homes that are required. And I have to say, when I hear Simon Harris, as he said on Tuesday, and Dara O'Brien saying they're building more social homes since the 70s, the problem is our population has doubled since then. Social housing need has doubled. To meet the same level of social housing need today as was done in the 1970s, you would actually have to double the output of social homes to about 15,000 a year. That's not even in the government's plan, okay, let alone close to what they're actually meeting. So the commissioner right on that, and our position has always been consistent.
All right. Sir, what do you make of this row over HAP supports? Do you think they're vital given where we are at the moment and everyone agrees that we're in a housing crisis? Or is it just handing over more money to private landlords and then driving up the prices?
Yeah, like no, I will never dispute that schemes like HAP are absolutely crucial in allowing people what is increasingly being seen as a luxury as opposed to a fundamental right, but access to housing. But this scheme in particular just seems to have gone off the rails, and it really is just kind of one example on how, you know, that symbiotic relationship between the private sector and government housing policy have just kind of blurred. The lines between them have blurred. HAP has proven to be inflationary. It's only one of the government's housing measures that have proven to be inflationary. Numerous, like Social Justice Ireland, numerous think tanks have come out and said that these measures just clearly aren't working. There was a study, and the name of it has escaped me now, but basically new figures recently showed that despite a marathon stream of interest rate hikes, which are meant to curb inflation, they're meant to stamp down prices, government measures have fueled house prices in that time. So we've had this kind of once in a generational stream of interest rate hikes, and house prices are still rising.
But you can't rectify that until supply comes on board.
You can't, no. And I think the kind of recommendation from the Housing Commission that really the way out of this is for the state to build homes and keep them and then seek investment elsewhere. But it is crucial that the government kind of owns these homes and that, you know, it's not in competition with the private rental sector. Because if you look, if you're a landlord in North Inner City Dublin and if you are signed up to the HAP scheme, mm-hmm, and you're saying, oh, well, the guy next door to me is charging €500 a month more than me, I should be able to charge that. You go back to the government, they say, OK, yeah, we'll give you the money so you can stay competitive. The guy next door to you is going to say, ah, oh, well, sure, he's on the HAP scheme. I'm going to add another 200 onto mine. You know, like that is kind of how it's working. And yeah, it's really just crucial that, like, the kind of, I suppose, there is a separation between moving forward if there is going to be reform to the housing sector.
Brenda, can we move to the issue of the referendum on housing? Because we know there wasn't agreement in the Housing Commission on this. We had a minority report. With your barrister's hat on, how would it work?
It would be an absolute disaster. And if you look at both the majority and the minority report, they both say that there is no need for a referendum on housing. There is no need for it. That the Constitution, Article 43, provides sufficient clarity to say that in the interest of social justice and in the interest of the common good, the government can regulate public property, private property rights already. And the only reason that the majority report have recommended an amendment, and before we get into the fun and games that's going to be around the actual wording of it, is to address what they say is perceptions around the fact that the Constitution doesn't allow this. First of all, it has never been tested. And secondly, they're both agreed, both the minority report, which was actually the chair, Ronan Lyons, subscribed to, mm-hmm, and the majority report agree it is not necessary. And the minority report specifically says basically what they are proposing is a referendum to address mistaken perceptions and to allow for virtue signalling, or as they call it, value signalling. And secondly, that if it is passed, in the unlikely event that we can agree on the definition of adequate housing, we couldn't agree on durable relationships, but we might be able to agree on adequate housing, even if we can, that all it will mean is an individual justiciable right to access to affordable housing or to access to adequate housing, which means you'll have individuals going to the courts getting damages. And
if I can just come into that, not even sure if it is justiciable, actually, speaking that's both as a politician and as a barrister as well. I think actually I agree with most of what Brenda says, but the other point I'd make is sometimes the knee-jerk reaction of politicians tends to be, and obviously I'm a politician myself, but let's have a referendum, let's put something to a vote, let's bring in new legislation, in this case a referendum. Not always the right answer. Putting something in the Constitution doesn't automatically make it happen. All rights in the Constitution are relative to each other. They're also, as Brenda correctly says, are subject to the common good. I think there is a bit of virtue signalling talk around this. But in terms of regulating property, it's already happening with the rent pressure zones. No landlord in the state can increase their rent by more than 2% anyway. So we already have rent controls. I hear people like Sinn Féin calling for rent controls. Well, we already have rent controls in the entire country.
But it's government policy, isn't it?
I think it's been talked about for a long time. I would be shocked if it happened in the lifetime of this government.
Your programme for government, though. So you're saying that you don't agree with that programme for government on this.
The problem with the referenda, as we've seen very recently, is that they tend to be about everything except the subject matter of the referendum. So I think we should be really careful going to the polls.
Well, you're running scared from referenda now. That's
I'm never a fan of multiple referenda. Personally, I think that they tend to be whatever the hot potato issue of the day is will be seized upon by campaigners. The other thing with the McKenna judgment that both sides get common ground. So even if the entire political system supporting one argument, 50% of the airtime is given to the other argument, which might have a 5% support.
Darragh O'Brien published the wording for this proposed referendum on the same day that we had the Housing Commission report. You're saying he's wrong?
I'm saying I don't see it as a magic solution.
Okay, it will send people to the courts, Eoghan O'Brien.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I want to commend James for his honesty, because it's at complete variance with Fianna Fáil's position. It is true government is deeply divided on this issue. Fine Gael does not want the referendum. Fianna Fáil's public position in the committee and on the floor of the Dáil and the Seanad is to support it. I'll disagree with one thing that Brenda has said, and I've read both of the reports. I think it's probably a crude characterisation to say that the majority report said that it's not necessary. That's not the import of the report. What it says is there's an argument that politicians have used traditionally, which is they can't do certain things because of property rights in the Constitution, and that is absolutely not that is not correct. But there are, and the report goes through them, there are lots of good reasons to have the right wording inserted in the Constitution. I think what we need to do with this actually is to do it correctly, unlike with the previous referenda, which is there's a draft wording. There's a majority and a minority report. And I actually think Michael O'Flynn and Ronan Lyons have done us a service, because now we have two documents from two sets of advocates setting out the reasons for and against. I think the correct thing to do is for government to proceed with the legislation, to have full and detailed pre-legislative scrutiny so the Oireachtas can do what we weren't allowed to do with the previous referenda, tease these things out. And then if government wants to, I don't believe this government will do it, and I think James is correct, but if a government in the future wants to do it, they get the wording right. Mm-hmm. Because I actually think the value of doing it this way is we have two very detailed analyses from two groups of very smart people, one arguing why we should do it, one arguing why we shouldn't.
But can you address that concern as articulated by Michael O'Flynn today, and indeed Brenda there, that there would be money spent now on defending claims that go to the courts that could be used to build homes?
So we've spent a lot of time in the Oireachtas Housing Committee considering this matter and listening to expert advice from countries that have already done this. And what they say is the significance of constitutionalising a right to housing is, one, is it does place an obligation on all governments through their policies, through the legislation and through their budgets to vindicate that right. It does also act as a catalyst for change, because it creates an expectation that something is going to be done differently. And while it does give people a justiciable right, it is only in the most extreme cases that those rights are brought to the courts and vindicated. And for example, if you had a family with severe special needs languishing in emergency accommodation for 4 or 5 years, and those things actually happen, are we seriously saying that a government who fails to provide that family with adequate and appropriate accommodation, that they shouldn't be able to go to the courts.
Okay.
But the most important aspect of it is it actually changes government policy and government action. That's not a theory. That's the way this has transpired in the real world where
but
this has happened.
Kind of hard
and that's
cases
why we should do
have
it.
Have actually been put on the long finger by the courts because the courts have given due deference to the Oireachtas. So there's been a number of cases about a decade ago where situations similar to what Owen described, very difficult hardship cases, people in difficult circumstances, particularly in the education sphere, looking for education for their children, went before the courts. There's a series of decisions and the courts stepped back from the brink of saying we're going to order this to happen because they recognise the separation of powers doctrine that the Parliament is separate to the courts. So that's one of the reasons I think I'm not convinced that this is a magic formula.
Okay,
I get the intention of it as positive, but I just don't know what's going on.
Nobody has argued it's a magic formula or a silver bullet. It is one of a number of tools. All of the other tools are outlined either in the opposition's alternative proposals or the good recommendations of the Commission,
which is
policy, legislation and budgets. But a legal right to housing, where it has been put in place, has positive outcomes, particularly for those least served well by bad government
okay,
policy.
Brenda, go
but
ahead.
No,
and I
just
think it's
say,
something we should do.
Do you accept the minority's position, though, that this is a systemic problem and not one to be addressed on a piecemeal basis, on the basis of individual rights? And secondly, you know that the retired Justice Deirdre Murphy said recently you have to be either a multimillionaire or a pauper to go to the courts at the moment. This will require people to be able to have access to the High Court. This is not a formula for an equal housing system.
It ignores the real import of the referendum. And again, I make the point, where housing rights have been constitutionalised or put in legislation, they impact on policy, they impact on legislation, they impact on budgets, they act as a catalyst for change and people's lives are better. I fully agree, by the way, with Michael and Ronan, because in the full and final report, they make the case for all the other systemic changes. Nobody's saying it's one or the other. We need those systemic changes, but we do also need a constitutional
right to house. Just some listener response to this. I can't afford to buy, I can't afford to rent and save a deposit, but I can afford to build on my site. But would a housing referendum allow me to get past the local needs planning rules? That's what I'm interested in. So you see how it's relevant to people who are living
this. But it also highlights how extremely complex it is. So the local needs rules are a function of planning law and a function, and really the reason for that, and I have great sympathy, and as you know, a large rural area in my own constituency, the reason people are not encouraged to build on their own land is because it's far more sustainable for society, for people to live in clusters in towns, for provision of services, for broadband, for roads, for footpaths, for cabling, for lighting, for power, the whole lot of it. But I have great sympathy. But we're talking about the cost of building, that came through very strongly in the report. And I'm listening to Owen with great interest, but we don't know how Sinn Féin are going to build houses for 300,000 in Dublin City at cost. You know, and then sell them if that means they must build them cheaper. And you know, I'm curious to know how that actually. And I think Owen mentioned his proposals. I've still to see actually how that can be done. And anyone doing any kind of construction at the moment, whether there's the smallest extension to the largest mansion, would see the cost of materials and labour and everything else is through the roof.
Yeah, your party leader came under pressure in the Dáil this week. People might have read Miriam Lord's report. You know, numerous people saying how when it comes to that €300,000 claim. We haven't heard how from Sinn Féin.
You have, because I published the detailed proposals in 2021 and I published an Irish Independent opinion
That's
piece.
3 years ago, inflation, cost of materials has jumped in the meantime.
Let me answer the question, because you asked it and it's a fair question. So we published how we can do it and I published an updated version of it. It's very, very straightforward. Nobody is saying you're building the home cheaper, right? What we're saying is you take the all-in development cost, which is the build, land, site servicing, utilities and development levies. The state pays for all those land-related costs and owns all of those, the site servicing and the utility connections. And the purchaser buys the home at the price of construction. If you take, for example, average all-in development costs for public homes in Dublin in the last year, 308,000 all-in development costs.
Are you saying that the site is excluded from the 300,000?
Just let me answer the question, James. You asked the question. The all-in development cost of a standard public home last year in Dublin was €308,000. If you were to take out the site costs, site servicing costs, utilities and levies, you can sell that home for €260,000. That is the facts. What's the conditions? It's your home. You get to own it. You get to amend it, alter it and pass it to your children and grandchildren. But the state retains ownership of the land. You get free, indefinite use of the public land for you and your children and your grandchildren. But there are two conditions in our scheme. One, you can't rent that property out in the private rental sector. It's a family home for you and subsequent generations. And two, when you want to sell it, you can sell it as you wish, but to future affordable purchasers at the future affordable purchase price. And that way we get privately owned, privately traded, but permanently affordable homes.
It sounds
we've set this out time and time again. And unlike the government scheme, where affordable homes under the government scheme in my constituency are costing €435,000, in the minister's own constituency, €565,000, we can deliver these homes below €300,000 right across the
state. Sarah, you want to come in? I'll let you back then.
I think really key to this Housing Commission report, and it was said by the chair himself, is that there needs to be cohesion across government policies as to how we are going to deliver. And this policy does not, although Dara O'Brien has claimed that he has already delivered a €300,000 home between all the various government supports, I would just like to know, like, how is this going to work in the long term? If Sinn Féin comes into government, a key recommendation is that there needs to be cohesion. But, you know, can Sinn Féin deliver that cohesion is what I'd really be looking at. Because, if you know, all the parties seem to be crucially at odds about this. Where is the way forward? You know, nobody's actually taking a step back and saying, OK, what are the common denominators between all of our policies and how are they working? How would they work? I think that there needs to be, like, as opposed to this just becoming a political row about what policies are better, there needs to be a step back and a kind of, OK, this realistically is going to take 25 years. You know, Housing for All is supposed to take 25 years, but it's not going to take 25 years if...
So the Sláinte Care strategy is what you're saying, that there would be a cross-party agreement
exactly.
on how to move forward on it.
I think that would be crucial.
We did that in 2016. So during the interregnum after the general election in 2016, a Dáil subcommittee was created. I sat in it. John Curran was the chair from Fianna Fáil, Colin Brophy, etc. And we spent an enormous amount of time doing a report and setting out 100 recommendations on a genuinely cross-party basis. Almost all of those were ignored, both in the Confidence and Supply Housing Plan, Rebuilding Ireland. And James is actually partially incorrect in his description of Confidence and Supply, because in advance of every budget, Fianna Fáil housing spokespersons, Dara O'Brien before and Barry Cowan, were brought in and included in those negotiations and actually claimed large parts of those budgets as housing budgets. But also many of those cross-party recommendations aren't in the current government's plan. I think this commission report gives us an opportunity to do some of that. But where policies are failing, like John O'Connor yesterday made the point, and he's right, the Affordable Housing Act, and particularly the Affordable Purchase and the Cost Rental, are absolutely key. And the legislation is fine. It's the implementation of those. And the scheme I've just outlined to you is consistent with the Affordable Housing Act. It would require very modest tweaks, but it would allow the state and private building contractors to build very, very large volumes of good quality homes for working families
really briefly,
to buy.
I want to move on.
Something
time
that Fianna Fáil currently are not delivering.
Absolutely. So, look, I welcome the fact that Owen has for the first time explained how the 300,000 houses might work.
I explained it in 2021,
That's 3 years ago.
And 2023.
We're under pressure time, so you might just...
You can't keep claiming we're not putting things in the public domain when they are there. In fact, when I put it in the public domain in 21 and 22, I was criticised because people didn't like the scheme. Then all of a sudden they forgot they actually heard about what the scheme was and they're saying it doesn't exist. The scheme is there, and unlike yours, it will deliver tens of thousands
quick
of genuine
point, James, affordable
homes
okay.
for working
scheme,
people. Something you're not doing.
Sorry, Owen, if I can speak. The scheme has been described, I welcome the description that's been given to Owen. I've heard it for the first time today. I think anyone involved in construction, even tangentially involved, will know 2021 is a world away from 2024, heading towards 2025. But it does appear from the description, we're talking about multi-generational obligations with terms and conditions of public home, from what I understand is on state land. Look, I welcome that the detail of it has been provided, but this does not sound like an across-the-board housing for all type solution. This sounds like quite a niche novel plan, and there may be some merits to it, and I'm certainly prepared to look at that. But let's not pretend that this is again a panacea or a magic silver bullet. It's not. It's a very specific plan.
I'm going to leave that one there because I do want to have a word about another important development this week. That was the decision of the Irish government to recognise the state of Palestine. And Brenda, this has been seen in Israel as a reward for Hamas. We've seen the video that emerged, and this is all following on from the brutal attack, of course, on October 7th. Does Israel have a point?
Yes, they do. And I mean, when you have Hamas welcoming your initiative, then I think you need to really check your moral compass. I think it is completely unacceptable that this decision was made without any terms or conditions being required. For example, the recognition of the State of Israel, the release of a single hostage. Not a single hostage has been released. The holding of hostages is in direct contravention of the Geneva Convention, and they're still being held. Children, babies, young women, old people. No sign of any of them being released, and no suggestion of any requirement that Hamas allow a democratic election, which they have not allowed in Gaza since 2006. And as recently as last summer, the people of Gaza were out on the streets begging for international support to overthrow Hamas. They had placards saying, "Let us live." They were beaten off the streets. streets, according to Amnesty International. There wasn't a word of support for them at that time here. So, I mean, this is a declaration that we could have made at any time in the past 20 years since the Oslo Accord.
So the timing
and the fact
is
that
wrong.
Timing cannot be seen as anything else but a reward for what Hamas did on the October the 7th.
James, how do you respond to that?
I think we have to separate the leadership in both situations, actually. I have zero time for Hamas, in fact, to condemn them completely. But equally, Netanyahu is not doing any favours for Israel at the moment. I think that it's legitimate to recognise the aspiration to nationhood of the Palestinian people.
But are you uncomfortable with the fact that Hamas welcomed that this week?
Yes, absolutely. Of course I am. I also am uncomfortable with the Israeli ambassador's video. The Israeli minister for foreign affairs who published a video showing the Hamas attacks, replaying them. And I'm not, there's many politicians in the Irish cycle that beat up in Israel all the time. I'm not one of them. I've great time for Israel, actually, in terms of the economic miracle, in terms of the innovation, in terms of their defence of their country against attacks from all comers. 1967 from all sides, 1948 attacked by five Arab nations surrounding them the day that they declared themselves as a new state. So I have sympathy for them. However, that sympathy has been severely mitigated by their actions over the last 6 months in terms of what they've been doing to Palestine and the tens of thousands of people that are, including many, many children that have been killed by them. So I think they've done themselves no favours at all, to put it mildly. But I think that the it's a legitimate aspiration. De Valera went on tour when we had our own infant independence around the world, the United States in particular, looking for countries to recognise us. And that happened, and that was a major part in us finally securing our independence in 1921 and subsequently.
Okay.
So I recognise what they're trying to do.
All right.
I think things like borders and government and the detail has to be hammered out.
Oh, no, Brian.
But I recognise
conditions should have been attached, says Brenda Power. What do you say?
Absolutely not. If you believe,
not one hostage released.
If you believe, as I do, that the solution to the conflict in the Middle East is the two-state solution, then you have to recognise both states. And one of the causes of the conflict, not just in its current incarnation, but over 100 years, is constant attempts by successive governments of Israel to undermine the viability of a Palestinian state. That's why Oslo collapsed, and that's why it has been so difficult to get a peace process back up and running. Both government and opposition have been very clear. We have all condemned Hamas. We have all called and repeatedly called for the hostages to be returned. We have all, with increasing volume, called for an end to the Israeli government's genocide against the Palestinian people. I don't support the ideology of Hamas. I don't support the ideology of Likud. Although ultimately, when the violence stops and a political process is put in place, it is a matter for the people of Israel and a matter for the people of Palestine to determine who their representatives are. And whoever they determine as their representatives, as we experience in our own peace process in the north, people who were previously at war are going to have to get into dialogue, and the international community is going to have to support that.
So we may have to recognise Hamas negotiate
and
with Hamas.
No matter how difficult that may be, our job is, one, to use every means possible to bring the violence to an end on all sides, but particularly the genocidal violence of the Israeli state. Two, to put in place the possibility of a pathway to peace. It is not for anybody in this studio to say whether the extreme right wing of Likud should represent the people of Israel or the extreme Islamicists of Hamas should represent Palestine. Those people have to decide that democratically themselves.
All right.
There are lots of strong, positive, progressive voices for peace.
Got to leave
but
it
we
there.
Need to focus on ending the genocide.
All right. Owen O'Brien, James Lawless, Sarah McGuinness and Brenda Power. Thank you all very much. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.